I will speak to her when I have your consent. Do you give it to me? Said Prince Andrei.
Yes, replied the Countess.
She held out her hand to him, and with a mixed feeling of estrangement and tenderness, pressed her lips to his forehead as he stooped to kiss her hand. She wished to love him as a son, but felt that to her he was a stranger and a terrifying man.
I am sure my husband will consent, said the Countess. But your father?
My father, to whom I have told my plans, has made it an express condition of his consent that the wedding is not to take place for a year, and I wished to tell you of that, said Prince Andrei.
It is true that Natasha is still young, but so long as that?
It is unavoidable, said Prince Andrei with a sigh.
I will send her to you, said the Countess, and left the room. Lord, have mercy upon us, she repeated while seeking her daughter.
Sonya said that Natasha was in her bedroom. Natasha was sitting on the bed, pale and dry-eyed, and was gazing at the icons and whispering something as she rapidly crossed herself. Seeing her mother, she jumped up and flew to her.
Well, Mama, well!
Go, go to him. He is asking for your hand, said the Countess. Coldly, it seemed to Natasha.
Go, go,
said the mother, sadly and reproachfully, with a deep sigh as her daughter ran away. Natasha never remembered how she entered the drawing-room. When she came in and saw him, she paused.
Is it possible that this stranger has now become everything to me?
She asked herself, and immediately answered,
Yes, everything. He alone is now dearer to me than everything in the world.
Prince Andrei came up to her with downcast eyes. I have loved you from the very first moment I saw you. May I hope? He looked at her and was struck by the serious, impassioned expression of her face. Her face said, Why ask? Why doubt what you cannot but know? Why speak when words cannot express what one feels? She drew near to him and stopped. He took her hand and kissed it. Do you love me?
Yes, yes,
Natasha murmured, as if in vexation. Then she sighed loudly, and catching her breath more and more quickly, began to sob.
What is it? What's the matter? Oh, I am so happy, she replied,
smiled through her tears, bent over closer to him, paused for an instant as if asking herself whether she might, and then kissed him. Prince Andrei held her hands, looked into her eyes, and did not find in his heart his former love for her. Something in him had suddenly changed. There was no longer the former poetic and mystic charm of desire, but there was pity for her feminine and childish weakness, fear at her devotion and trustfulness, and an oppressive yet joyful sense of the duty that now bound him to her forever. The present feeling, though not so bright and poetic as the former, was stronger and more serious. Did your mother tell you that it cannot be for a year? Asked Prince Andrei, still looking into her eyes.
Is it possible that I, the chit of a girl, as everybody called me, thought Natasha, is it possible that I am now to be the wife and the equal of this strange, dear, clever man, whom even my father looks up to? Can it be true? Can it be true that there can be no more playing with life, that now I am grown up, that on me now lies a responsibility for my every word and deed? Yes. But what did he ask me?
No, she replied, but she had not understood his question. Forgive me, he said, but you are so young, and I have already been through so much in life. I am afraid for you. You do not yet know yourself. Natasha listened with concentrated attention, trying but failing to take in the meaning of his words. "Hard as this year which delays my happiness will be," continued Prince Andrei, "it will give you time to be sure of yourself. I ask you to make me happy in a year, but you are free. Our engagement shall remain a secret, and should you find that you do not love me, or should you come to love," said Prince Andrei with an unnatural smile.
"Why do you say that?" Natasha interrupted him. "You know that from the very day you first came to Otradnoye I have loved you," she cried, quite convinced that she spoke the truth.
"In a year you will learn to know yourself."
"A whole year?"
Natasha repeated suddenly, only now realizing that the marriage was to be postponed for a year.
"But why a year? Why a year?"
Prince Andrei began to explain to her the reasons for this delay. Natasha did not hear him.
"And can't it be helped?" she asked.
Prince Andrei did not reply, but his face expressed the impossibility of altering that decision.
"It's awful! Oh, it's awful, awful!"
Natasha suddenly cried and again burst into sobs.
"I shall die waiting a year. It's impossible. It's awful."
She looked into her lover's face and saw in it a look of commiseration and perplexity.
"No, no, I'll do anything," she said, suddenly checking her tears. "I am so happy."
The father and mother came into the room and gave the betrothed couple their blessing. From that day, Prince Andrei began to frequent the Rostovs as Natasha's affianced lover. Chapter 24. Prince Andrei's last days with Natasha. No betrothal ceremony took place, and Natasha's engagement to Bolkonski was not announced. Prince Andrei insisted on that. He said that as he was responsible for the delay, he ought to bear the whole burden of it, that he had given his word and bound himself forever, but that he did not wish to bind Natasha and gave her perfect freedom. If after 6 months she felt that she did not love him, she would have full right to reject him. Naturally, neither Natasha nor her parents wished to hear of this, but Prince Andrei was firm. He came every day to the Rostovs, but did not behave to Natasha as an affianced lover. He did not use the familiar thou, but said you to her, and kissed only her hand. After their engagement, quite different, intimate, and natural relations sprang up between them. It was as if they had not known each other till now. Both liked to recall how they had regarded each other when as yet they were nothing to one another. They felt themselves now quite different beings. Then they were artificial, now natural and sincere. At first the family felt some constraint in their relations with Prince Andrei. He seemed a man from another world, and for a long time Natasha trained the family to get used to him, proudly assuring them all that he only appeared to be different, but was really just like all of them, and that she was not afraid of him, and no one else ought to be. After a few days they grew accustomed to him, and without restraint in his presence, pursued their usual way of life, in which he took his part. He could talk about rural economy with the Count, fashions with the Countess and Natasha, and about albums and fancy work with Sonia. Sometimes the household, both among themselves and in his presence, expressed their wonder at how it had all happened, and at the evident omens there had been of it. Prince Andrei's coming to Otradnoye, and their coming to Petersburg, and the likeness between Natasha and Prince Andrei, which her nurse had noticed on his first visit, and Andrei's encounter with Nikolai in 1805, and many other incidents betokening that it had to be. In the house, that poetic dullness and quiet reigned, which always accompanies the presence of a betrothed couple. Often, when all sitting together, everyone kept silent. Sometimes the others would get up and go away, and the couple, left alone, still remained silent. They rarely spoke of their future life. Prince Andrei was afraid and ashamed to speak of it. Natasha shared this, as she did all his feelings, which she constantly divined. Once she began questioning him about his son. Prince Andrei blushed, as he often did now. Natasha particularly liked it in him, and said that his son would not live with them.
"Why not?" asked Natasha in a frightened tone.
"I cannot take him away from his grandfather, and besides..."
"How I should have loved him," said Natasha,
immediately guessing his thought.
"But I know you wish to avoid any pretext for finding fault with us."
Sometimes the old count would come up, kiss Prince Andrei, and ask his advice about Petya's education or Nikolai's service. The old countess sighed as she looked at them. Sonya was always getting frightened lest she should be in the way and tried to find excuses for leaving them alone, even when they did not wish it. When Prince Andrei spoke, he could tell a story very well, Natasha listened to him with pride. When she spoke, she noticed with fear and joy that he gazed attentively and scrutinizingly at her. She asked herself in perplexity,
"What does he look for in me? He is trying to discover something by looking at me. What if what he seeks in me is not there?"
Sometimes she fell into one of the mad, merry moods characteristic of her, and then she particularly loved to hear and see how Prince Andrei laughed. He seldom laughed, but when he did, he abandoned himself entirely to his laughter, and after such a laugh she always felt nearer to him. Natasha would have been completely happy if the thought of the separation awaiting her and drawing near had not terrified her, just as the mere thought of it made him turn pale and cold. On the eve of his departure from Petersburg, Prince Andrei brought with him Pierre, who had not been to the Rostovs once since the ball. Pierre seemed disconcerted and embarrassed. He was talking to the countess, and Natasha sat down beside a little chess table with Sonya, thereby inviting Prince Andrei to come too. He did so.
"You have known Bezukhov a long time?" he asked. "Do you like him?"
"Yes, he's a dear, but very absurd."
And as usual when speaking of Pierre, she began to tell anecdotes of his absent-mindedness, some of which had even been invented about him.
"Do you know, I have entrusted him with our secret. I have known him from childhood. He has a heart of gold."
"I beg you, Natalie," Prince Andrei said with sudden seriousness, "I am going away, and heaven knows what may happen. You may cease to..."
"All right, I know I'm not to say that. Only this, then. Whatever may happen to you when I am not here..."
"What can happen?"
"Whatever trouble may come," Prince Andrei continued, "I beg you, Mademoiselle Sonya, whatever may happen, to turn to him alone for advice and help. He is a most absent-minded and absurd fellow, but he has a heart of gold."
Neither her father nor her mother, nor Sonya nor Prince Andrei himself, could have foreseen how the separation from her lover would act on Natasha. Flushed and agitated, she went about the house all that day, dry-eyed, occupied with most trivial matters, as if not understanding what awaited her. She did not even cry when, on taking leave, he kissed her hand for the last time.
"Don't go,"
she said in a tone that made him wonder whether he really ought not to stay, and which he remembered long afterwards. Nor did she cry when he was gone. But for several days she sat in her room dry-eyed, taking no interest in anything, and only saying now and then,
"Oh, why did he go away?"
But a fortnight after his departure, to the surprise of those around her, she recovered from her mental sickness just as suddenly and became her old self again, but with a change in her moral physiognomy, as a child gets up after a long illness, with a changed expression of face. Chapter 25. Prince Nikolai Bolkonski and Princess Maria. During that year after his son's departure, Prince Nikolai Bolkonski's health and temper became much worse. He grew still more irritable, and it was Princess Maria who generally bore the brunt of his frequent fits of unprovoked anger. He seemed carefully to seek out her tender spots so as to torture her mentally as harshly as possible. Princess Maria had two passions, and consequently two joys,
her nephew, little Nikolai, and religion, and these were the favourite subjects of the prince's attacks and ridicule. Whatever was spoken of, he would bring round to the superstitiousness of old maids or the petting and spoiling of children.
"You want to make him, little Nikolai, into an old maid like yourself. A pity! Prince Andrei wants a son and not an old maid," he would say.
Or turning to Mademoiselle Bourienne, he would ask her in Princess Maria's presence how she liked our village priests and icons and would joke about them. He continually hurt Princess Maria's feelings and tormented her, but it cost her no effort to forgive him. Could he be to blame toward her, or could her father, whom she knew loved her in spite of it all, be unjust? And what is justice? The princess never thought of that proud word, justice. All the complex laws of man centered for her in one clear and simple law, the law of love and self-sacrifice, taught us by him who lovingly suffered for mankind, though he himself was God. What had she to do with the justice or injustice of other people? She had to endure and love, and that she did. During the winter, Prince Andrei had come to Bald Hills and had been gay, gentle, and more affectionate than Princess Maria had known him for a long time past. She felt that something had happened to him, but he said nothing to her about his love. Before he left, he had a long talk with his father about something, and Princess Maria noticed that before his departure, they were dissatisfied with one another. Soon after Prince Andrei had gone, Princess Maria wrote to her friend Julie Karagina in Petersburg, whom she had dreamed, as all girls dream, of marrying to her brother, and who was at that time in mourning for her own brother, killed in Turkey.
"Sorrow, it seems, is our common lot, my dear tender friend Julie. Your loss is so terrible that I can only explain it to myself as a special providence of God, who, loving you, wishes to try you and your excellent mother. Oh, my friend, religion and religion alone can, I will not say comfort us, but save us from despair. Religion alone can explain to us what without its help man cannot comprehend. Why, for what cause, kind and noble beings able to find happiness in life, not merely harming no one, but necessary to the happiness of others, are called away to God, while cruel, useless, harmful persons, or such as are a burden to themselves and to others, are left living. The first death I saw, and one I shall never forget, that of my dear sister-in-law, left that impression on me. Just as you ask destiny why your splendid brother had to die, so I asked why that angel Lisa, who not only never wronged anyone, but in whose soul there were never any unkind thoughts, had to die. And what do you think, dear friend? 5 years have passed since then, and already I, with my petty understanding, begin to see clearly why she had to die, and in what way that death was but an expression of the infinite goodness of the Creator, whose every action, though generally incomprehensible to us, is but a manifestation of his infinite love for his creatures. Perhaps, I often think, she was too angelically innocent to have the strength to perform all a mother's duties. As a young wife, she was irreproachable. Perhaps she could not have been so as a mother. As it is, not only has she left us, and particularly Prince Andrei, with the purest regrets and memories, but probably she will there receive a place I dare not hope for myself. But not to speak of her alone, that early and terrible death has had the most beneficent influence on me and on my brother, in spite of all our grief. Then, at the moment of our loss, these thoughts could not occur to me. I should then have dismissed them with horror, but now they are very clear and certain. I write all this to you, dear friend, only to convince you of the gospel truth which has become for me a principle of life. Not a single hair of our heads will fall without his will, and his will is governed only by infinite love for us. And so,
Whatever befalls us is for our good. You ask whether we shall spend next winter in Moscow. In spite of my wish to see you, I do not think so, and do not want to do so. You will be surprised to hear that the reason for this is Buonaparte. The case is this. My father's health is growing noticeably worse. He cannot stand any contradiction and is becoming irritable. This irritability is, as you know, chiefly directed to political questions. He cannot endure the notion that Buonaparte is negotiating on equal terms with all the sovereigns of Europe, and particularly with our own, the grandson of the great Catherine. As you know, I am quite indifferent to politics, but from my father's remarks and his talks with Mikhail Ivanovich, I know all that goes on in the world, and especially about the honours conferred on Buonaparte, who only at Bald Hills in the whole world, it seems, is not accepted as a great man, still less as Emperor of France. And my father cannot stand this. It seems to me that it is chiefly because of his political views that my father is reluctant to speak of going to Moscow, for he foresees the encounters that would result from his way of expressing his views regardless of anybody. All the benefit he might derive from a course of treatment he would lose as a result of the disputes about Buonaparte, which would be inevitable. In any case, it will be decided very shortly. Our family life goes on in the old way, except for my brother Andrei's absence. He, as I wrote you before, has changed very much of late. After his sorrow, he only this year quite recovered his spirits. He has again become as I used to know him when a child, kind, affectionate, with that heart of gold to which I know no equal. He has realized, it seems to me, that life is not over for him. But together with this mental change, he has grown physically much weaker. He has become thinner and more nervous. I am anxious about him, and glad he is taking this trip abroad which the doctors recommended long ago. I hope it will cure him. You write that in Petersburg he is spoken of as one of the most active, cultivated, and capable of the young men. Forgive my vanity as a relation, but I never doubted it. The good he has done to everybody here, from his peasants up to the gentry, is incalculable. On his arrival in Petersburg, he received only his due. I always wonder at the way rumours fly from Petersburg to Moscow, especially such false ones as that you write about. I mean the report of my brother's betrothal to the little Rostova. I do not think my brother will ever marry again, and certainly not her. And this is why. First, I know that though he rarely speaks about the wife he has lost, the grief of that loss has gone too deep in his heart for him ever to decide to give her a successor and our little angel a stepmother. Secondly, because as far as I know, that girl is not the kind of girl who could please Prince Andrei. I do not think he would choose her for a wife, and frankly, I do not wish it. But I am running on too long, and am at the end of my second sheet. Goodbye, my dear friend. May God keep you in his holy and mighty care. My dear friend Mademoiselle Bourienne sends you kisses. Maria. Chapter 26. In the middle of summer, Princess Maria received an unexpected letter from Prince Andrei in Switzerland, in which he gave her strange and surprising news. He informed her of his engagement to Natasha Rostova. The whole letter breathed loving rapture for his betrothed and tender and confiding affection for his sister. He wrote that he had never loved as he did now, and that only now did he understand and know what life was. He asked his sister to forgive him for not having told her of his resolve when he had last visited Bald Hills, though he had spoken of it to his father. He had not done so for fear Princess Maria should ask her father to give his consent, irritating him and having to bear the brunt of his displeasure without attaining her object. Besides, he wrote, the matter was not then so definitely settled as it is now. My father then insisted on a delay of a year, and now already 6 months, half of that period, have passed, and my resolution is firmer than ever.
If the doctors did not keep me here at the spas, I should be back in Russia. But as it is, I have to postpone my return for 3 months. You know me and my relations with Father. I want nothing from him. I have been and always shall be independent. But to go against his will and arouse his anger, now that he may perhaps remain with us such a short time, would destroy half my happiness. I am now writing to him about the same question, and beg you to choose a good moment to hand him the letter, and to let me know how he looks at the whole matter, and whether there is hope that he may consent to reduce the term by 4 months. After long hesitations, doubts, and prayers, Princess Maria gave the letter to her father. The next day, the old prince said to her quietly,
"Write and tell your brother to wait until I am dead. It won't be long. I shall soon set him free."
The princess was about to reply, but her father would not let her speak, and raising his voice more and more, cried,
"Marry! Marry, my boy! A good family! Clever people, eh? Rich, eh? Yes, a nice stepmother little Nikolai will have. Write and tell him that he may marry tomorrow if he likes. She will be little Nikolai's stepmother, and I'll marry Bourienne. He mustn't be without a stepmother either. Only one thing. No more women are wanted in my house. Let him marry and live by himself. Perhaps you will go and live with him too," he added, turning to Princess Maria. "Go, in heaven's name! Go out into the frost, the frost, the frost!"
After this outburst, the prince did not speak any more about the matter, but repressed vexation at his son's poor-spirited behaviour found expression in his treatment of his daughter. To his former pretexts for irony, a fresh one was now added, allusions to stepmothers and amiabilities to Mademoiselle Bourienne.
"Why shouldn't I marry her?" he asked his daughter. "She'll make a splendid princess."
And latterly, to her surprise and bewilderment, Princess Maria noticed that her father was really associating more and more with the Frenchwoman. She wrote to Prince Andrei about the reception of his letter, but comforted him with hopes of reconciling their father to the idea. Little Nikolai and his education, her brother Andrei and religion, were Princess Maria's joys and consolations. But besides that, since everyone must have personal hopes, Princess Maria, in the profoundest depths of her heart, had a hidden dream and hope that supplied the chief consolation of her life. This comforting dream and hope were given her by God's folk, the half-witted and other pilgrims who visited her without the prince's knowledge. The longer she lived, the more experience and observation she had of life, the greater was her wonder at the short-sightedness of men who seek enjoyment and happiness here on earth, toiling, suffering, struggling, and harming one another to obtain that impossible, visionary, sinful happiness. Prince Andrei had loved his wife. She died, but that was not enough. He wanted to bind his happiness to another woman. Her father objected to this because he wanted a more distinguished and wealthier match for Andrei. And they all struggled and suffered and tormented one another and injured their souls, their eternal souls, for the attainment of benefits which endure but for an instant. Not only do we know this ourselves, but Christ, the Son of God, came down to earth and told us that this life is but for a moment and is a probation. Yet we cling to it and think to find happiness in it. How is it that no one realizes this? Thought Princess Maria. No one except these despised God's folk who, wallet on back, come to me by the back door, afraid of being seen by the prince, not for fear of ill usage by him, but for fear of causing him to sin. To leave family, home, and all the cares of worldly welfare in order, without clinging to anything, to wander in hempen rags from place to place under an assumed name, doing no one any harm, but praying for all, for those who drive one away as well as for those who protect one. Higher than that life and truth, there is no life or truth. There was one pilgrim, a quiet, pockmarked little woman of 50 called Theodosia, who for over 30 years had gone about barefoot and worn heavy chains. Princess Maria was particularly fond of her. Once, when in a room with a lamp dimly lit before the icon, Theodosia was talking of her life, the thought that Theodosia alone had found the true path of life suddenly came to Princess Maria with such force that she resolved to become a pilgrim herself. When Theodosia had gone to sleep, Princess Maria thought about this for a long time, and at last made up her mind that, strange as it might seem, she must go on a pilgrimage. She disclosed this thought to no one but to her confessor, Father Akinfi, the monk, and he approved of her intention. Under guise of a present for the pilgrims, Princess Maria prepared a pilgrim's complete costume for herself, a coarse smock, bast shoes, a rough coat, and a black kerchief. Often, approaching the chest of drawers containing this secret treasure, Princess Maria paused, uncertain whether the time had not already come to put her project into execution. Often, listening to the pilgrims' tales, she was so stimulated by their simple speech, mechanical to them, but to her so full of deep meaning, that several times she was on the point of abandoning everything and running away from home. In imagination, she already pictured herself by Theodosia's side, dressed in coarse rags, walking with a staff, a wallet on her back, along the dusty road, directing her wanderings from one saint's shrine to another, free from envy, earthly love, or desire, and reaching at last the place where there is no more sorrow or sighing, but eternal joy and bliss. "I shall come to a place and pray there, and before having time to get used to it or getting to love it, I shall go farther. I will go on till my legs fail, and I'll lie down and die somewhere, and shall at last reach that eternal quiet haven where there is neither sorrow nor sighing," thought Princess Maria. But afterwards, when she saw her father, and especially little Coco, Nikolai, her resolve weakened. She wept quietly, and felt that she was a sinner who loved her father and her little nephew more than God. Book 7, 1810 to 1811. Chapter 1. Nikolai Rostov returns home on leave. The Bible legend tells us that the absence of labor, idleness, was a condition of the first man's blessedness before the fall. Fallen man has retained a love of idleness, but the curse weighs on the race not only because we have to seek our bread in the sweat of our brows, but because our moral nature is such that we cannot be both idle and at ease. An inner voice tells us we are in the wrong if we are idle. If man could find a state in which he felt that though idle he was fulfilling his duty, he would have found one of the conditions of man's primitive blessedness. And such a state of obligatory and irreproachable idleness is the lot of a whole class, the military. The chief attraction of military service has consisted and will consist in this compulsory and irreproachable idleness. Nikolai Rostov experienced this blissful condition to the full when, after 1807, he continued to serve in the Pavlograd regiment, in which he already commanded the squadron he had taken over from Denisov. Rostov had become a bluff, good-natured fellow, whom his Moscow acquaintances would have considered rather bad form, but who was liked and respected by his comrades, subordinates, and superiors, and was well contented with his life. Of late, in 1809, he found in letters from home more frequent complaints from his mother that their affairs were falling into greater and greater disorder, and that it was time for him to come back to gladden and comfort his old parents. Reading these letters, Nikolai felt a dread of their wanting to take him away from surroundings in which, protected from all the entanglements of life, he was living so calmly and quietly. He felt that sooner or later he would have to re-enter that whirlpool of life with its embarrassments and affairs to be straightened out, its accounts with stewards, quarrels and intrigues, its ties, society, and with Sonya's love and his promise to her. It was all dreadfully difficult and complicated, and he replied to his mother in cold, formal letters in French, beginning, "My dear Mama," and ending, "Your obedient son," which said nothing of when he would return. In 1810 he received letters from his parents in which they told him of Natasha's engagement to Bolkonski, and that the wedding would be in a year's time because the old prince made difficulties. This letter grieved and mortified Nikolai. In the first place, he was sorry that Natasha, for whom he cared more than for anyone else in the world, should be lost to the home, and secondly, from his hussar point of view, he regretted not to have been there to show that fellow Bolkonski that connection with him was no such great honour after all, and that if he loved Natasha, he might dispense with permission from his dotard father. For a moment he hesitated whether he should not apply for leave in order to see Natasha before she was married, but then came the manoeuvres and considerations about Sonya and about the confusion of their affairs, and Nikolai again put it off. But in the spring of that year he received a letter from his mother, written without his father's knowledge, and that letter persuaded him to return. She wrote that if he did not come and take matters in hand, their whole property would be sold by auction and they would all have to go begging. The Count was so weak and trusted Mitenka so much and was so good-natured that everybody took advantage of him and things were going from bad to worse. "For God's sake, I implore you, come at once if you do not wish to make me and the whole family wretched," wrote the Countess. This letter touched Nikolai. He had that common sense of a matter-of-fact man which showed him what he ought to do. The right thing now was, if not to retire from the service, at any rate to go home on leave. Why he had to go he did not know, but after his after-dinner nap he gave orders to saddle Mars, an extremely vicious grey stallion that had not been ridden for a long time, and when he returned with the horse all in a lather, he informed Lavrushka, Denisov's servant who had remained with him, and his comrades who turned up in the evening, that he was applying for leave and was going home. Difficult and strange as it was for him to reflect that he would go away without having heard from the staff, and this interested him extremely, whether he was promoted to a captaincy or would receive the Order of St. Anne for the last manoeuvres, strange as it was to think he would go away without having sold his three roans to the Polish Count Goluchowski, who was bargaining for the horses Rostov had betted he would sell for 2,000 rubles. Incomprehensible as it seemed that the ball the hussars were giving in honour of the Polish Mademoiselle Brzazieska, out of rivalry to the Uhlans, who had given one in honour of their Polish Mademoiselle Borozovska, would take place without him. He knew he must go away from this good, bright world to somewhere where everything was stupid and confused. A week later he obtained his leave. His hussar comrades, not only those of his own regiment, but the whole brigade, gave Rostov a dinner to which the subscription was 15 rubles a head, and at which there were 2 bands and 2 choirs of singers. Rostov danced the trepak with Major Bazov. The tipsy officers tossed, embraced, and dropped Rostov. The soldiers of the 3rd Squadron tossed him too, and shouted, "Hurrah!" And then they put him in his sleigh and escorted him as far as the 1st post station. During the first half of the journey, from Kremenchug to Kiev, all Rostov's thoughts, as is usual in such cases, were behind him with the squadron. But when he had gone more than halfway, he began to forget his 3 roans and Dozhoyveiko, his quartermaster, and to wonder anxiously how things would be at Otradnoye, and what he would find there. Thoughts of home grew stronger the nearer he approached it, far stronger, as though this feeling of his was subject to the law by which the force of attraction is in inverse proportion to the square of the distance. At the last post station before Otradnoye, he gave the driver a 3-ruble tip, and on arriving he ran breathlessly, like a boy, up the steps of his home. After the rapture of meeting, and after that odd feeling of unsatisfied expectation, the feeling that everything is just the same, so why did I hurry? Nikolai began to settle down in his old home world. His father and mother were much the same, only a little older. What was new in them was a certain uneasiness and occasional discord, which there used not to be, and which, as Nikolai soon found out, was due to the bad state of their affairs. Sonya was nearly 20. She had stopped growing prettier and promised nothing more than she was already, but that was enough. She exhaled happiness and love from the time Nikolai returned, and the faithful, unalterable love of this girl had a gladdening effect on him. Petya and Natasha surprised Nikolai most. Petya was a big, handsome boy of 13, merry, witty, and mischievous, with a voice that was already breaking. As for Natasha, for a long while Nikolai wondered and laughed whenever he looked at her. "You're not the same at all," he said.
"How? Am I uglier?"
"On the contrary. But what dignity!"
"A princess,"
he whispered to her.
"Yes, yes, yes," cried Natasha joyfully.
She told him about her romance with Prince Andrei and of his visit to Otradnoye, and showed him his last letter.
"Well, are you glad?" Natasha asked. "I am so tranquil and happy now."
"Very glad," answered Nikolai. "He is an excellent fellow. And are you very much in love?"
"How shall I put it?" replied Natasha. "I was in love with Boris, with my teacher, and with Denisov, but this is quite different. I feel at peace and settled. I know that no better man than he exists, and I am calm and contented now, not at all as before."
Nikolai expressed his disapproval of the postponement of the marriage for a year, but Natasha attacked her brother with exasperation, proving to him that it could not be otherwise, and that it would be a bad thing to enter a family against the father's will, and that she herself wished it so.
"You don't at all understand," she said.
Nikolai was silent and agreed with her. Her brother often wondered as he looked at her. She did not seem at all like a girl in love and parted from her affianced husband. She was even-tempered and calm and quite as cheerful as of old. This amazed Nikolai and even made him regard Bolkonski's courtship sceptically. He could not believe that her fate was sealed, especially as he had not seen her with Prince Andrei. It always seemed to him that there was something not quite right about this intended marriage. "Why this delay? Why no betrothal?" he thought. Once, when he had touched on this topic with his mother, he discovered to his surprise and somewhat to his satisfaction that in the depth of her soul she too had doubts about this marriage.
"You see, he writes," said she,
showing her son a letter of Prince Andrei's, with that latent grudge a mother always has in regard to a daughter's future married happiness.
"He writes that he won't come before December. What can be keeping him? Illness, probably. His health is very delicate. Don't tell Natasha, and don't attach importance to her being so bright. That's because she's living through the last days of her girlhood. But I know what she is like every time we receive a letter from him. However, God grant that everything turns out well." She always ended with these words. "He is an excellent man."
Chapter 2. Nikolai settles accounts with Mitenka. After reaching home, Nikolai was at first serious and even dull. He was worried by the impending necessity of interfering in the stupid business matters for which his mother had called him home. To throw off this burden as quickly as possible, on the third day after his arrival he went, angry and scowling and without answering questions as to where he was going, to Mitenka's lodge, and demanded an account of everything. But what an account of everything might be, Nikolai knew even less than the frightened and bewildered Mitenka. The conversation and the examination of the accounts with Mitenka did not last long. The village elder, a peasant delegate, and the village clerk, who were waiting in the passage, heard with fear and delight first the young count's voice roaring and snapping and rising louder and louder, and then words of abuse, dreadful words, shouted one after the other. "Robber! Ungrateful wretch! I'll hack the dog to pieces! I'm not my father! Robbing us!" and so on. Then, with no less fear and delight, they saw how the young count, red in the face and with bloodshot eyes, dragged Mítenka out by the scruff of the neck and applied his foot and knee to his behind with great agility at convenient moments between the words, shouting, "Be off! Never let me see your face here again, you villain!" Mítenka flew headlong down the 6 steps and ran away into the shrubbery. This shrubbery was a well-known haven of refuge for culprits at Otradnoye. Mítenka himself, returning tipsy from the town, used to hide there, and many of the residents at Otradnoye, hiding from Mítenka, knew of its protective qualities. Mítenka's wife and sisters-in-law thrust their heads and frightened faces out of the door of a room where a bright samovar was boiling and where the steward's high bedstead stood with its patchwork quilt. The young count paid no heed to them, but, breathing hard, passed by with resolute strides and went into the house. The countess, who heard at once from the maids what had happened at the lodge, was calmed by the thought that now their affairs would certainly improve, but on the other hand felt anxious as to the effect this excitement might have on her son. She went several times to his door on tiptoe and listened as he lighted one pipe after another. Next day the old count called his son aside and, with an embarrassed smile, said to him, "But you know, my dear boy, it's a pity you got excited. Mítenka has told me all about it." "I knew," thought Nikolai, "that I should never understand anything in this crazy world."
"You were angry that he had not entered those 700 rubles, but they were carried forward, and you did not look at the other page. Papa, he is a blackguard and a thief, I know he is, and what I have done, I have done. But if you like, I won't speak to him again." "No, my dear boy." The count, too, felt embarrassed. He knew he had mismanaged his wife's property and was to blame toward his children, but he did not know how to remedy it. "No, no, I beg you to attend to the business. I am old, I—" "No, papa. Forgive me if I have caused you unpleasantness. I understand it all less than you do." "Devil take all these peasants and money matters and carryings forward from page to page," he thought. "I used to understand what a corner and the stakes at cards meant, but carrying forward to another page I don't understand at all," said he to himself, and after that he did not meddle in business affairs. But once the countess called her son and informed him that she had a promissory note from Anna Mikhailovna for 2,000 rubles, and asked him what he thought of doing with it. "This," answered Nikolai. "You say it rests with me? Well, I don't like Anna Mikhailovna and I don't like Boris, but they were our friends and poor. Well then, this," and he tore up the note, and by so doing caused the old countess to weep tears of joy. After that, young Rostov took no further part in any business affairs, but devoted himself with passionate enthusiasm to what was to him a new pursuit, the chase, for which his father kept a large establishment. Chapter 3. Nikolai Goes Hunting. The weather was already growing wintry, and morning frosts congealed an earth saturated by autumn rains. The verdure had thickened, and its bright green stood out sharply against the brownish strips of winter rye trodden down by the cattle, and against the pale yellow stubble of the spring buckwheat. The wooded ravines and the copses, which at the end of August had still been green islands amid black fields and stubble, had become golden and bright red islands amid the green winter rye. The hares had already half changed their summer coats, the fox cubs were beginning to scatter, and the young wolves were bigger than dogs. It was the best time of year for the chase. The hounds of that ardent young sportsman Rostov had not merely reached hard winter condition, but were so jaded that at a meeting of the huntsmen it was decided to give them a 3 days' rest, and then, on the 16th of September, to go on a distant expedition, starting from the oak grove, where there was an undisturbed litter of wolf cubs. All that day the hounds remained at home. It was frosty and the air was sharp, but toward evening the sky became overcast and it began to thaw. On the 15th, when young Rostov in his dressing gown looked out of the window,
He saw it was an unsurpassable morning for hunting. It was as if the sky were melting and sinking to the earth without any wind. The only motion in the air was that of the dripping, microscopic particles of drizzling mist. The bare twigs in the garden were hung with transparent drops, which fell on the freshly fallen leaves. The earth in the kitchen garden looked wet and black and glistened like poppy seed, and at a short distance merged into the dull, moist veil of mist. Nikolai went out into the wet and muddy porch. There was a smell of decaying leaves and of dog. Milka, a black-spotted, broad-haunched bitch with prominent black eyes, got up on seeing her master, stretched her hind legs, lay down like a hare, and then suddenly jumped up and licked him right on the nose and moustache. Another borzoi, a dog, catching sight of his master from the garden path, arched his back and, rushing headlong toward the porch with lifted tail, began rubbing himself against his legs.
"Ahoy!"
came at that moment that inimitable huntsman's call which unites the deepest bass with the shrillest tenor, and round the corner came Daniel, the head huntsman and head kennelman, a grey, wrinkled old man with hair cut straight over his forehead, Ukrainian fashion, a long, bent whip in his hand, and that look of independence and scorn of everything that is only seen in huntsmen. He doffed his Circassian cap to his master and looked at him scornfully. This scorn was not offensive to his master. Nikolai knew that this Daniel, disdainful of everybody and who considered himself above them, was all the same his serf and huntsman. "Daniel," Nikolai said timidly, conscious at the sight of the weather, the hounds, and the huntsman, that he was being carried away by that irresistible passion for sport which makes a man forget all his previous resolutions, as a lover forgets in the presence of his mistress.
"What orders, Your Excellency?"
said the huntsman in his deep bass, deep as a proto-deacon's and hoarse with hallooing, and two flashing black eyes gazed from under his brows at his master, who was silent. "Can you resist it?" those eyes seemed to be asking. "It's a good day, eh? For a hunt and a gallop, eh?" asked Nikolai, scratching Milka behind the ears. Daniel did not answer, but winked instead.
"I sent to Varka at dawn to listen," his bass boomed out after a minute's pause. "He says she's moved them into the old Tradnoye enclosure. They were howling there."
This meant that the she-wolf, about whom they both knew, had moved with her cubs to the Otradnoye copse, a small place a mile and a half from the house. "We ought to go, don't you think so?" said Nikolai. "Come to me with Uvarka."
"As you please."
"Then put off feeding them."
"Yes, sir."
5 minutes later, Daniel and Uvarka were standing in Nikolai's big study. Though Daniel was not a big man, to see him in a room was like seeing a horse or a bear on the floor among the furniture and surroundings of human life. Daniel himself felt this, and as usual stood just inside the door, trying to speak softly and not move for fear of breaking something in the master's apartment, and he hastened to say all that was necessary so as to get from under that ceiling, out into the open, under the sky once more. Having finished his inquiries and extorted from Daniel an opinion that the hounds were fit, Daniel himself wished to go hunting, Nikolai ordered the horses to be saddled. But just as Daniel was about to go, Natasha came in with rapid steps, not having done up her hair or finished dressing, and with her old nurse's big shawl wrapped round her. Petya ran in at the same time.
"You are going?" asked Natasha. "I knew you would. Sonya said you wouldn't go, but I knew that today is the sort of day when you couldn't help going."
"Yes, we are going," replied Nikolai reluctantly, for today, as he intended to hunt seriously, he did not want to take Natasha and Petya. "We are going, but only wolf hunting. It would be dull for you."
"You know it is my greatest pleasure," said Natasha. "It's not fair. You are going by yourself and are having the horses saddled and said nothing to us about it."
"No barrier bars a Russian's path. We'll go," shouted Petya.
"But you can't. Mama said you mustn't," said Nikolai to Natasha.
Yes, I'll go. I shall certainly go, said Natasha decisively. Daniel, tell them to saddle for us, and Mikhail must come with my dogs, she added to the huntsman.
It seemed to Daniel irksome and improper to be in a room at all, but to have anything to do with a young lady seemed to him impossible. He cast down his eyes and hurried out, as if it were none of his business, careful as he went not to inflict any accidental injury on the young lady. Chapter 4 The Wolf Hunt Begins. The old count, who had always kept up an enormous hunting establishment, but had now handed it all completely over to his son's care, being in very good spirits on this 15th of September, prepared to go out with the others. In an hour's time, the whole hunting party was at the porch. Nikolai, with a stern and serious air which showed that now was no time for attending to trifles, went past Natasha and Petya, who were trying to tell him something. He had a look at all the details of the hunt, sent a pack of hounds and huntsmen on ahead to find the quarry, mounted his chestnut, Donets, and whistling to his own leash of bourgeois, set off across the threshing ground to a field leading to the Otradnoye wood. The old count's horse, a sorrel gelding called Vifyanka, was led by the groom in attendance on him, while the count himself was to drive in a small trap straight to a spot reserved for him. They were taking 54 hounds, with 6 hunt attendants and whippers-in. Besides the family, there were 8 bourgeois kennelmen and more than 40 bourgeois, so that with the bourgeois on the leash belonging to members of the family, there were about 130 dogs and 20 horsemen. Each dog knew its master and its call. Each man in the hunt knew his business, his place, what he had to do. As soon as they had passed the fence, they all spread out evenly and quietly, without noise or talk, along the road and field leading to the Otradnoye covert. The horses stepped over the field as over a thick carpet, now and then splashing into puddles as they crossed a road. The misty sky still seemed to descend evenly and imperceptibly toward the earth. The air was still, warm, and silent. Occasionally the whistle of a huntsman, the snort of a horse, the crack of a whip, or the whine of a straggling hound could be heard. When they had gone a little less than a mile, 5 more riders with dogs appeared out of the mist, approaching the Rostovs. In front rode a fresh-looking, handsome old man with a large grey moustache.
"Good morning, Uncle," said Nikolai when the old man drew near.
"That's it, come on, I was sure of it,"
began Uncle. He was a distant relative of the Rostovs, a man of small means and their neighbour.
"I knew you wouldn't be able to resist it, and it's a good thing you're going. That's it, come on."
This was Uncle's favourite expression.
"Take the covert at once, for my Gerchik says the Ilyagins are at Korniki with their hounds. That's it, come on. They'll take the cubs from under your very nose."
"That's where I'm going. Shall we join up our packs?" asked Nikolai.
The hounds were joined into one pack, and Uncle and Nikolai rode on side by side. Natasha, muffled up in shawls which did not hide her eager face and shining eyes, galloped up to them. She was followed by Petya, who always kept close to her, Mikhail, a huntsman, and by a groom appointed to look after her. Petya, who was laughing, whipped and pulled at his horse. Natasha sat easily and confidently on her black Arabchik and reined him in without effort with a firm hand. Uncle looked round disapprovingly at Petya and Natasha. He did not like to combine frivolity with the serious business of hunting.
"Good morning, Uncle. We're going too," shouted Petya.
"Good morning, good morning. But don't go over-riding the hounds," said Uncle sternly.
"Nikolai, what a fine dog Trunilla is. He knew me," said Natasha, referring to her favourite hound.
"In the first place, Trunilla is not a dog, but a harrier," thought Nikolai, and looked sternly at his sister, trying to make her feel the distance that ought to separate them at that moment. Natasha understood it.
"You mustn't think we'll be in anyone's way, Uncle," she said. "We'll go to our places and won't budge."
"A good thing too, little Countess," said Uncle. "Only mind you don't fall off your horse," he added, "because that's it. Come on, you've nothing to hold on to."
The oasis of the Otradnoye covert came in sight a few hundred yards off. The huntsmen were already nearing it. Rostov, having finally settled with Uncle where they should set on the hounds, and having shown Natasha where she was to stand, a spot where nothing could possibly run out, went round above the ravine.
"Well, nephew, you're going for a big wolf," said Uncle.